I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Henry Detweiler. Henry, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Floyd?
Doing well. Glad to have you in and have a chance to talk. We cross paths fairly often, but haven't really had a chance to sit down and talk in quite some time. So one of the things that always strikes me about you and your work is a sense of emotion.
Yeah.
And I wonder about you as a person, how you process various emotions, either happiness or sadness. What is that like for you?
I don't know. I think it's kind of hard to describe because I think I process my emotions very intuitively. I think, you know, I think making work helps me process my emotions. I'm glad that comes through in the work because I think that's an important thing. There's always, and it's always both things. It's always happiness and sadness and like funniness combined into this one thing. I think these things aren't really not separable from one another. I don't know exactly how to answer that.
I think that whenever we talk in person, there's, you know, you're typically in a good mood. Mm-hmm. And then when I see your work, there seems to be a certain melancholiness to it, to a certain extent. But then, as you mentioned, there's some layers where there's a little bit of humor in that. So it's mm-hmm. not all of that, but there's a little bit of humor or sarcasm or lighter moments sprinkled into that sort of melancholiness.
I think that's, you know, there's like the face that you show to the world, and there's the internal way of, you know, processing the world. And I think the art sort of is a way of sharing that internal way that I experience the world, you know. So there's so there's definitely a lot of sadness, a lot of funniness, irony, whatever, you know. It's all sort of, yeah, like I said, it's one big thing that, picking apart, I guess.
And when it comes to material choices,
mm-hmm.
talk about maybe how you work through certain material choices and maybe play around with things before you finally get to a place where you're comfortable with a particular representation.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think I definitely attribute a lot of my, technical ability to my, having gone through a painting BFA program. So I know how to use canvas. I know how to, make these things work for me. But as far as getting down to the nitty gritty of just selecting what to use and when to use it, I think that's really just happens sort of intuitively. It's whatever will best serve what I want to do with that piece. So yeah, for instance, the show that was here, Never Lonely, it had a range of things. It had, some paintings on canvas that are pretty, pretty straightforward as far as materials go. But then, there's the Mylar balloon sculpture and then the installation that's made of all these sort of fragmented pieces that were sort of collected from eBay in advance of the show. And then, the video piece. It's really just whatever will best serve the idea that dictates what I choose. And then there's always room to learn new things, with each piece and sort of, how to properly do something or how to consciously reject how to properly do something. That's all part of it. And it's all about, in particular, if I'm creating a whole exhibition rather than creating just individual objects, it's about, yeah, whatever will best serve the whole atmosphere of the thing.
So talking about Never Lonely, mm-hmm. can you delve a little bit deeper into what the idea of that exhibit was all about? And you mentioned the balloon sculpture, mm-hmm. which is always interesting for a lot of people. But just talk more generally about what the sort of big idea was around Never Lonely.
Yeah, so I've been sort of reflecting on it because sort of immediately after, well, producing, it was all new work for the show, and sort of being in the thick of making the work, and it was sort of hard to reflect on what it was really about. But I think sort of being a few months removed from it, I'm starting to recognize that it was sort of a reaction to what had been a pretty challenging year for me personally. Yeah, and then sort of with my art, I don't want it to be read as a literal narrative or autobiographical reaction thing. So I think the general theme was this sort of melancholic, you know, mid-20s ennui thing, you know, just sort of, yeah, just, I wanted to create this general sense of, you know, restlessness or malaise or just sort of creating this atmosphere of what I had been feeling up until then. And sort of the way that came to me was just these iconic images or, you know, iconic images, I guess, that became very important to the show initially. So, like, the palm tree motif, like this lonely palm tree, you know, but sort of neon and lurid. And somehow that's, like, somehow contradictory nature of that, and then it brings up this, I don't know, I always imagined, like, someone being alone at a bar drinking and looking at this, like, sad single palm tree. Yeah, that became important. And then Mariah Carey's Always Be My Baby, like, sort of this, that song was really important to the show, and it was featured in a couple of the pieces in the video piece, and then the Xerox pieces with the phone number that you could call. That song would play as this sort of, I don't know, this iconic pop song that is saying so much but saying nothing at the same time. Yeah, like that inherently contradictory nature. And yeah, it's like, I think, inherently contradictory nature of being, you know, a young person struggling, like trying to be as authentic of a person as possible while also being mired in, like, this, you know, this culture that doesn't seem to value that and how we use these things that are not ourselves to represent ourselves. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that you don't always want your work to take on this autobiographical tone.
Right.
But it seems as though there's some element of your own perspective in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's impossible for the work to not somehow be reflective of me, because it comes from me. Like, I think it's probably the most authentic expression of myself, although, you know, I take measures to intentionally sort of remove myself from it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the same way with, you know, with a writer or with a poet or whatever, you know, it's, you know, this is your art, and it's saying something about you, but it's also saying something about us. Right. So
in your work, when you are sort of balancing the perspective of, I guess, your first person input, mm-hmm. but also your third person sort of vantage point to create the work, what What is the most challenging part about sort of that removal process, or creating some distance, or just enough distance mm-hmm. from Henry, the person?
I think that's always been sort of an intuitive thing as well. I think I'm just not. I've never really been interested in, autobiography in that way. It seems more relevant, I guess, for my own practice to somehow be more reflective, or less. I think being enigmatic or less specific about things leaves a space for conversation. So if I were to do something that is like a one to one. Like, this piece is about this, or, the show is about this thing, which is about me. Like, that would, that shuts down the conversation automatically. I went through a phase last year where I was reading and thinking about Tolkien a lot, J.R.R. Tolkien. And in the preface, or in the introduction to the first American printing of The Lord of the Rings, he has this... He goes on this rant about how, not really a rant, it's like a very thoughtful essay, about how he just dislikes allegory. And I really agree with that. So Tolkien says, essentially, after The Lord of the Rings had initially been published, people started trying to read it as an allegory of World War II and sort of, equating, one character to this, historical personage, like this... Sauron is Hitler, or, Frodo is, whatever, that whole sort of thing. And he dislikes that because, for the same reason, it rather than it being applicable, which is the word he uses, the story being applicable to everything, or having applicability for the reader, it becomes about the author if it's a one-to-one relation to that. So applicability is preferred to allegory. So I think that's what I would like to create. I think that's a useful way for me to think about my work,
especially when it comes to leaving room for conversation. And right. I wonder, in going back to maybe this sort of authentic representation of your feelings about last year and the Never Lonely piece and what it may represent, I wonder, for you, what were some interesting conversations that maybe you had with maybe other artists? Because I feel like artists talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And maybe there were elements in Never Lonely that may have come from you, but maybe could have been reflections of sentiments from other artists or other 20-somethings in your similar position. So I wonder about conversations that you have or artists have around kind of where they are in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, at least from my experience, it's hard for... I think people in my social group or of my age group in general, like, do a lot of talking around things rather than talking about things. So, I haven't had a totally straightforward conversation about the work or like this feeling in this way. It's I think we with artists, I think it's we're pointing at things with our work, but maybe we're not talking about them with each other. And I think in the general pop culture as well, like at this moment, there's like people like Lena Dunham, who is definitely exploring this sort of, you know, 20-something milieu, whatever, with, you know, the show Girls, and like, and that's part of the zeitgeist, and that's like part of the, like this moment that we're happening, and it's sort of generally interesting, but also maybe not directly discussed among peer groups. I don't know if that answered the question.
Well, let me ask you this: when it comes to maybe that hesitancy or the apprehension around maybe talking really about things, is that a function, in your opinion, of maybe some difficulties being vulnerable enough to have those kind of conversations?
Possibly. Yeah, I mean, I think... go ahead.
No. And I guess let me sort of give more context to that question. So I think about the world that we live in terms of a digital era, social era world, where we have a lot more access to people. And so with that access, there is also a layer or this boundary where people try to at least have something left that isn't so easily accessible, which makes it difficult to be very vulnerable in some ways to people and to be as forthright in some conversations. So that's where I was coming from with the question about vulnerability.
No, I definitely think that that's a reaction. This difficulty, this challenge of being vulnerable or authentic, I think that's a pretty clear, there's some connection with, you know, the fact that we live so much of our lives, and, you know, I live so much of my life online, and, you know, I have this representation of myself that I put out into the world, and, you know, like based on the content I share, or the photos I post or whatever. But yeah, I feel very protective of the vulnerability, like the thing that is just for myself or for, you know, those who are closest to me, or, you know, actually just for myself. You know, you have to hold something, you have to keep something on. But I think, you know, the more we talk around the things that we are afraid to talk about, the more clearly those things, the shape of those things becomes more clearly defined. It's like, you know, you're filling in the negative space, and then, you know, all that's left is this, you know, nugget of vulnerability or authenticity. So in that way, you know, using social media or, you know, these pop culture or things to sort of represent ourselves, that's also, you know, in a contradictory way, sort of stripping away the, you know, the removal. Yeah. You know? So like all that's left is this one thing that we're not talking about. I don't know if that made sense, but I think about it that way. I think about it in sort of filling in the negative space around what we don't want to say.
Staying on that notion of space, I wanted to get your perspective on how you interact with space. So here in the Wonderroot Gallery, the Never Lonely show was sort of built for that space.
Yes.
You also were involved with the No Vacancy Dashboard Co-op exhibition as well. So where you were locked into a certain space for a period of time. So when you're confronted with space or lack of space in a certain capacity in your work, how do you work through your creative process when it comes to space?
So it is definitely, I find it's helpful to, when I'm making new work, to, if I have, you know, a location that will, you know, eventually receive the work and I'm making work for that specific space, because I think the results are generally more focused and maybe more cohesive. So for No Vacancy, my collaborator Ben Coleman and I, we were locked in that space, and all we had to go off of were each other and the space, and, you know, how we interacted with each other in that space and sort of the ideas that were created. It was our universe, right? And so I guess I wanted to, although I wasn't locked in Wonderroot, I wanted to treat the Wonderroot gallery space with the same sort of consideration, and just sort of, it became the works developed consciously with the space in mind. So I knew what I wanted to be where and how I wanted things to relate to each other. So it's very important, and it's really luxurious, like being given the opportunity to, you know, create all new work for an exhibition, which is not, yeah, I don't think that's, I'm very grateful for that, you know, that I got to know where the work was going to go. Right.
What spaces either inspire you or frighten you?
I think I'm not really afraid of much, but at least in terms of space, I think spaces that inspire me are more psychological spaces. I'm not really one to, I mean, I'm sure I'm influenced by my environment. I know I am. I'm influenced by my physical environment, you know, where I live and how I live there. But I think my work is a lot more cerebral and, if there are spaces that inspire me or, things that I, spaces that I draw on for influence, I guess, and probably be, like the, so for the larger installation in Never Lonely with the wall mural of the ocean and the blinds and the neon sign sort of sitting on the horizon line like a sunset, that I think that was drawing from this like idea of a sort of like a Floridian motel, like a rundown like 1960s poorly kept up motel thing. So I think, I'm interested in motels, I guess. Yeah, and that is terrifying.
Even from a psychological perspective, what psychological spaces inspire you?
I think the psychological space of feeling isolated, that really influenced Never Lonely. Sort of this attempt but failure to connect, with other people or with the, with my environment in some way, like being removed, being in my head, like that space has really influenced that. I think that was the space that I really pulled the work from, for Never Lonely. Yeah, and titling it Never Lonely when it's all about being isolated is, you know, contradictory and kind of funny at the same time.
How often do you think we're aware of those psychological spaces?
Mm. I think it's...
I mean, like, consciously aware. I think that we're somewhat emotionally aware of things, but, like,
right.
consciously aware of where we are in that psychological space context.
I think rarely, you know. I'm usually just experiencing, you know, moments, you know, from one moment to the next. Like, I'm not, it's, you know, I think I've become more, as I, you know, working through Never Lonely and sort of the, you know, just the self-work that I've been doing on myself, or, you know, trying to do with myself over the past several months, just trying to be more mindful of, mindful and present, I guess. And that has really helped, you know, draw into focus how much time I spend in my own head and how much that has influenced me, you know, like, you know, to the benefit of my artwork, but maybe to the detriment of my, you know, personal life. I think it's a practice of, it's a practice, you know, having to, like, come into awareness and becoming aware of this, and it's something I'm definitely working on, but it's not something I would have naturally done. You know, I think, you know, leading up till recently, I haven't been conscious of these psychological spaces. I've just been experiencing them. Yeah.
Henry Detweiler, let all of our listeners know how they can keep up with you and what you're working on and your upcoming exhibitions and all of that great stuff.
So you can reach me at my website, henrydetweiler.net. I own the .com, but I don't know how to get it. I think it's been purchased by this weird Japanese domain company, so, and their website's in Japanese. So anyway, so henrydetweiler.net. So you can reach me there. Things I have working on, or I have coming up, I'm going to be in a show at Swan Coach House Gallery, which is, I was a finalist for the Ford Arts Foundation Emerging Artist Award. So that's coming up in April. There's an exhibition I am potentially going to be taking part in at the Mammal Gallery, which I think will also be happening in April or early May. If you want more information about the No Vacancy piece, it was just profiled in a book that was released by Ugly Duckling Press, the end of December-ish. And the book is called Emergency Index Volume 3. So you can get that on Amazon or their website. It's a nice book. It's a sort of an index of just artists' performance art projects from 2013. So it's good information to have to look at. So that's pretty much it.
Great. Henry Detweiler, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Floyd.